Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Today, we're kicking off a deep dive into a truly compelling mystery. Did you know that a significant portion of human cancers, somewhere between, say, 15% to 20% globally, are actually linked to infections? And maybe 8% to 10% are caused directly by viruses, these things often called oncoviruses?
Yeah, and what's really astonishing, I think, is the sleeper agent nature of these links. You know, a tumor might not even emerge until years, sometimes decades, after the initial infection.
Decades, wow.
Exactly. I mean, imagine cervical cancer developing maybe 25, even 30 years after an HPV infection, or liver cancer popping up 10 to 30 years after hepatitis B or C. These viruses definitely play the long game.
And that raises a fascinating and really critical question, doesn't it? How can a virus like Epstein-Barr, EBV, which infects, well, most of the global population, end up causing cancer in only this tiny fraction of individuals? And what really happens inside our cells when these viruses finally, you know, push things towards malignancy? This deep dive is all about uncovering the unique characteristics, that distinct biological blueprint of these virus-associated cancers. We're really looking for the hidden pathways that make them tick differently. Before we go any deeper, though, we really have to acknowledge the incredible research that brings us these kinds of insights. It's the sort of work that genuinely pushes the boundaries of what we know.
Absolutely. Today, we're celebrating the really groundbreaking efforts of the research team led by Raul Rabadon and his colleagues. And we should definitely mention Yuni Nam and Karen Gomez, who contributed equally to this huge undertaking. They're from top institutions like Columbia University, the National Research Council in Italy, and the Institute for Advanced Study. Their comprehensive analysis, honestly, it's profoundly advanced our understanding of the fundamental differences between virus-positive and virus-negative cancers. It really feels like a game changer.
So let's unpack this a bit. We've known about oncoviruses for a while, right?
Yeah.
But what was the sort of big picture problem this study was trying to tackle? What were we still missing?
That's exactly right. Oncoviruses aren't exactly new to science. We know of 7 that are officially linked to human cancers, things like human papillomavirus, HPV, Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, hepatitis B and C, human herpes virus 8, HTLV-1, and Merkel cell polyomavirus.
Okay.
But here's the puzzle. The exact factors that actually drive a normal infected cell to become malignant, well, they remain largely unknown. And we especially lack understanding about what factors are common across these different types of virus-associated cancers.
And why is getting that common understanding so crucial, you know, on a global scale?
Well, because these cancers represent a really substantial global health burden, and they disproportionately affect developing countries where the incidence rates can be significantly higher.
Ah, okay.
So identifying those commonalities across these various virus-associated cancers could potentially unlock entirely new, broad strategies for prevention and treatment. It could impact millions worldwide.
Understood. So if we look at the oncoviruses we know about, what are some of the general patterns that researchers have already observed over time?
Well, first, they all tend to cause persistent long-term infections. The tumors often appear years, like we said, even decades after the initial exposure. That's pattern one.
Okay, persistence.
Second, these viruses produce specific proteins, viral proteins, that directly contribute to turning a normal cell cancerous. The classic example, you know, is HPV's E6 and E7 oncoproteins.
Right. I've heard of those.
Yeah. They famously shut down critical tumor suppressor genes like P53 and RB. They basically disarm the cell's natural brakes against uncontrolled growth.
Got it.
And third, and this is a really critical point, the viral infection itself isn't always enough to cause cancer. Think about EBV. Something like 90 to 95% of people worldwide are infected, HPV. Around 80% of individuals will get an infection by age 45.
Wow, that high.
Exactly. Yet, only a tiny, tiny fraction of those infected people ever actually develop cancer. This strongly suggests that other factors, maybe genetic, maybe environmental, perhaps immune factors, are also at play, pushing that infected cell towards malignancy.
And this study, then, really dives into those very factors you just mentioned. It's searching for those deeper connections beyond just, is the virus there or not?
Precisely. The team pulled together just an enormous amount of data. nearly 2,000 tumors across 9 different cancer types linked to 5 different viruses. Their whole mission was to identify common patterns in epidemiology, you know, who gets them and where, but also the unique genomic changes inside these cancers and even how these tumors respond to therapy. It's a true big data approach to tackle a massive biological puzzle.
That sounds like quite an undertaking.
Yeah.
So how did the researchers actually get to the bottom of these differences between the virus positive and the virus negative tumors? What kind of sophisticated tools did they use for such a widespread analysis?
Yeah, this was a colossal comparative analysis. They aggregated somatic mutation data from 1,971 tumors. And this was a mix of data types, whole exome sequencing, targeted DNA sequencing, whole genome sequencing pulled from a range of previously published studies. Plus, they generated brand new data specifically for Kaposi sarcoma.
Okay.
This allowed them to compare genetic changes across a really wide spectrum of cancers, but using a consistent methodology, which is key.
So they were really scrutinizing the genetic changes within the tumor cells themselves. Looking deep inside.
Yes, absolutely. Deep genomic analyses are really the core of their work. For instance, they mapped mutation signatures. These are like unique fingerprints left on the DNA by different kinds of damage processes.
Fingerprints, okay.
Yeah, imagine each type of DNA damage, say from smoking or UV light, leaves its own characteristic pattern, its own mark. They were able to read those marks to understand the underlying causes of the mutations.
Interesting.
They also looked at things like structural variants and copy number changes in the chromosomes, basically. Big rearrangements or changes in how many copies of certain genes there are.
Right.
And they analyzed chromosomal instability signatures. These tell you how often chromosomes are being sort of missegregated or lost during cell division, which indicates a chaotic cellular environment that often promotes cancer.
So a sign of instability.
Exactly. And finally, they zoomed right in on recurrently mutated genes. They were searching for specific genes that were altered much more frequently in the virus positive versus the virus negative tumors, looking for those key genetic switches that might be different.
That's a lot of genomic detective work. But did they also look at how these genetic differences might play out clinically? Especially, you know, in terms of how patients respond to treatment.
Absolutely. That was a crucial part of their methodology. They evaluated how the virus status correlated with the response to immunotherapy, specifically the PD-L1 inhibitors, which are a major class of cancer drugs now.
Right, the checkpoint inhibitors.
Exactly. And they did this by meticulously analyzing data from 32 different clinical trials. That's an impressive scope. So they weren't just looking at the genetic blueprint. They were connecting it to real-world patient outcomes.
That's a powerful combination, connecting the lab bench directly to the patient's bedside, essentially.
Indeed. And to really understand the why behind that immunotherapy response, they also delved deep into the tumor's immune microenvironment.
The neighborhood around the tumor.
Precisely. They looked at things like PD-L1 expression, which is kind of like a don't attack me flag that cancer cells can wave to hide from the immune system. They also studied the infiltration of CD8 plus T cells. These are the immune system's direct killer cells, the ones that actually attack cancer.
The frontline soldiers.
You got it. And they analyzed T-cell receptor clonal selection. This basically tells you how focused and effective the immune system's search and destroy mission is against those specific cancer cells. This kind of holistic approach allowed them to connect the dots across different levels from the DNA itself to the broader immune system's interaction with the tumor.
Okay, so after all that meticulous analysis, wading through all that data, what were the most striking, maybe even surprising discoveries that emerged from their deep dive?
Well, the findings were quite remarkable, actually, and they illustrated some really distinct trends that truly differentiate these virus-associated cancers.
Let's start with who gets these cancers. Did they find any clear demographic patterns?
Yes. One very notable observation was a higher frequency of virus-positive tumors in males. Across the board, really, virus-associated cancers showed a greater male-to-female ratio compared to their non-viral counterparts. This trend was particularly clear in things like gastric cancer and Hodgkin lymphoma.
Interesting. And geography plays a role too, right? It's not just about sex differences.
Yeah, exactly right. There are notable geographic hotspots. For example, EBV-positive Hodgkin lymphoma is more common in places like North Africa, the Middle East, and South America. whereas EBV-positive nasopharyngeal carcinoma is highly concentrated in China and Southeast Asia.
Wow.
And these disparities aren't just random. They reflect real differences in risk factors, like how common the oncovirus is in that population, but also local lifestyle factors that can influence cancer risk.
Okay, now shifting gears to the very heart of the cell, the DNA itself. What did the genomic analysis reveal about the differences in mutations between these virus-positive and virus-negative tumors?
Right. This is where it gets really, really interesting. Generally speaking, virus-positive tumors had a lower count of somatic mutations. Those are the non-inherited ones that accumulate over time compared to their virus-negative counterparts.
Lower mutation count.
Yes, lower count. This was a pretty consistent finding across most of the cancers they studied, like head and neck squamous cell carcinoma and primary central nervous system lymphoma. It strongly suggests a different pathway to malignancy is being used.
But there's always an exception that kind of proves the rule, isn't there?
You know it. In hepatocellular carcinoma, that's a type of liver cancer, and also in Burkitt lymphoma, the virus-positive cases actually showed a greater total mutation load.
Oh, okay. So the opposite.
The opposite, yeah. These cases where virus-positive tumors actually have more mutations are really intriguing. It suggests that maybe in some scenarios, the virus isn't just reducing the need for mutations, but it might actually be causing some DNA damage itself. Or perhaps, like in Burkitt lymphoma, specific viral proteins like EBNA1 can directly substitute for the need for those classic cancer-driving gene mutations.
Okay, that makes sense. Any other surprising mutational insights that really stood out?
Yes, the mutation signatures, those fingerprints we talked about, were quite distinct. For example, HPV-positive head and neck cancer showed a much higher presence of something called APOBEC mutations. Yeah, these suggest that the HPV proteins might actually be kickstarting some of our own cellular enzymes that normally fight viruses, but in this context, they ironically end up causing more mutations in the host's DNA. It's like a defense mechanism gone wrong.
Huh. Like friendly fire.
Kind of, yeah. In contrast, if you look at Merkel cell carcinoma, the virus-positive tumors had significantly fewer UV light-related mutations compared to the virus-negative ones. This strongly implies that the virus itself is taking over the primary cancer initiation role, reducing the need for sun-used DNA damage to get the cancer started.
And what about the specific genes that were frequently mutated? Were there clear patterns there too, beyond the overall count or the signatures?
Yes, and this is a truly key finding. Virus-negative tumors had significantly higher odds of mutations in common, well-known tumor suppressor genes like TP53 and CDKN2A.
The usual suspects.
Exactly, the usual suspects. These are genes we often immediately associate with cancer development, acting as those crucial brakes on cell growth. But in stark contrast, the virus-positive tumors showed increased mutations in a specific set of RNA helicase genes, particularly DDX3X and EIF4A1.
RNA helicases. That sounds specific.
It is. And DDX3X mutations, very interestingly, were strongly associated with EBV-positive Burkitt lymphoma. And here's a really striking detail. 96% of the truncating DDX3X mutations, those are the ones that essentially break the gene and cause a loss of its function, occurred in males.
96% in males. Mm-hmm. That male bias in DDX3X, especially with the loss of function mutation, that's really fascinating. So it points to very distinct genetic pathways being active depending on whether a virus is present.
Precisely. It strongly suggests that the virus itself is providing alternative oncogenic mechanisms, alternative ways to drive cancer. This essentially reduces the need for the cells to acquire mutations in those traditional tumor suppressors like TP53. The virus is doing some of that oncogenic work, if you will. And that loss of function for DDX3X implies it can no longer do its normal job, which might include keeping the cell in check. So losing it could act as a major accelerant for certain virus-associated cancers, particularly, it seems, in men.
The clinical implications of that finding, thinking about treatment, seem truly significant. What does this mean for how doctors might approach patient care based on virus status?
Right. This is perhaps one of the most immediately impactful findings for patients and for clinicians. The study found a really significant association between virus positivity and a higher treatment response rate to those PD-L1 immunotherapies.
Higher response. Yeah.
This was especially evident in gastric cancer and head and neck squamous cell carcinoma. And this finding is particularly surprising because, as we said, virus-positive tumors generally have that lower total mutation burden. Typically, a high mutation burden is thought to correlate with a better immunotherapy response because more mutations mean more targets for the immune system.
Right, that's the usual thinking.
Exactly. So this study kind of flips that conventional wisdom on its head, at least for these specific virus-associated cancers.
So why the better response then, if it's not simply due to a higher mutation burden? What's happening differently in the immune system in these cases?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And the researchers really dug into it. What they observed in the virus-positive gastric and head and neck cancers was increased CD8 plus T-cell infiltration.
More killer T-cells getting into the tumor.
Exactly. And higher T-cell receptor clonal selection. What this combination means is that the immune system, specifically those powerful killer T-cells, seems to be more actively recruited to the tumor and more specifically targeted against those virus-associated tumor cells.
So the immune system is already more engaged.
It seems so. This pre-existing, more robust immune activity likely makes them more susceptible to immunotherapy. The immunotherapy drug then just acts like a switch, or maybe like taking the foot off the brake, to fully reactivate and boost that already present response.
So, connecting all these dots, what does this all mean when we look at the bigger picture of how cancer develops and how we might treat it?
Well, I think this study profoundly highlights that virus-associated cancers really are a distinct biological entity. They're not just cancers that happen to have a virus hanging around. They have their own unique epidemiological patterns, a very different genomic landscape, and crucially, unique therapeutic vulnerabilities. It builds strongly on previous work by showing these commonalities across a really broad range of cancer types, not just looking at one cancer in isolation.
That male predominance you mentioned earlier for virus-associated cancers, that really stood out. Any more thoughts on why that might be the case?
It's a fascinating question. It could very well be linked to some kind of immunological predisposition. We know that females generally exhibit a more robust immune response to infections overall. This is influenced by a complex mix of factors, you know, from genes on the X chromosome to hormonal differences. This potentially stronger immune surveillance in females might offer some protective advantage against the virus persisting long enough or triggering the changes needed for cancer development.
Okay. That makes sense. And the lower overall mutation burden in most of these virus-positive tumors, that's quite a departure from what we often think about with many other cancers driven by environmental damage or aging. What's the leading hypothesis there again?
Yeah, what's really fascinating here is the hypothesis that the viral proteins themselves are providing much of the necessary oncogenic activity, the hits needed to turn a cell cancerous. This then reduces the selective pressure for the host cell to acquire numerous additional somatic mutations to become fully malignant.
So the virus is essentially driving the car, meaning you don't need as many individual engine modifications, so to speak.
That's a good analogy, yeah. The virus is doing a lot of the driving.
Let's delve just a bit more into those specific RNA helicase gene mutations you mentioned, DDX3X and EIK4A1. Why are they so significant specifically in virus-associated cancers? What do these genes normally do?
Right. So these RNA helicases, you can think of them as molecular unravelers or maybe rewinders in our cells. They're crucial for reading and processing our genetic code stored in RNA. They play key roles in really fundamental cellular processes and also, interestingly, in innate immunity, the body's first line of defense against pathogens.
Okay.
DDX3X in particular is complex. It can act as both a tumor suppressor and, surprisingly, sometimes as an oncogene, depending on the cellular context. Its frequent mutation in these cancers, especially that striking male bias for the truncating loss-of-function mutations, strongly suggests that losing DDX3X function might be a really key step in the development of certain virus-associated cancers, like EBV-positive Burkitt lymphoma. It really opens up new avenues for understanding their specific pathogenesis and maybe developing therapies that target this pathway.
And circling back to the immunotherapy response, that positive signal in virus-positive cancers, that feels like a potential paradigm shift for how we treat these specific cancers. What does this mean for patients and doctors moving forward?
It really is a powerful implication. The increased T-cell infiltration and the focused clonal T-cell response in virus-positive gastric and head and neck cancers strongly suggest that the high immunogenicity, the ability to provoke an immune response of the viral antigens, the viral proteins within these tumors, actually primes the immune system to recognize and attack them from the start.
So the immune system sees the viral bits as foreign.
Exactly. Immunotherapy then acts like this potent switch, reactivating and supercharging that pre-existing immune response, making it far more effective than it might be in a tumor without those viral flags. This could genuinely mean that assessing a patient's virus status becomes a critical biomarker for predicting whether they're likely to respond well to immunotherapy.
So a new tool for doctors.
A new tool, absolutely. Imagine we now have a new, perhaps unexpected, biomarker to help guide potentially life-saving immunotherapy decisions, especially in cancers where maybe it wasn't previously considered as effective.
Now, with any study this broad, are there any limitations to keep in mind or clear next steps needed for this line of research?
Oh, absolutely. As with any comprehensive study like this, there are always nuances. This analysis, for instance, focused on the most significantly differentially mutated genes across the entire pan-cancer cohort they studied.
Okay.
What that means is some known associations that occur in specific cancer types might not have met the stringent statistical threshold needed for pan-cancer significance in this analysis. For example, mutations in the TERT promoter region, which are known to be common in HPV-positive head and neck cancers, weren't captured here because the study primarily focused on mutations within the protein-coding parts of genes, the exons, and generally excluded promoter regions.
So technical limitations based on the analysis scope.
Exactly. So future studies will definitely need to incorporate larger, perhaps even more diverse cohorts. And they'll need to look at additional genetic factors, like those promoter mutations, and also epigenetic factors, changes that affect gene activity without changing the DNA sequence itself, to further expand and refine our understanding. There's always more to learn, more layers to peel back.
So ultimately, this study really paints a picture of two quite distinct models for how cancer can develop, doesn't it?
Yes, I think that's a great way to put it. One model is where accumulated random mutations, perhaps from aging or exposure to environmental carcinogens, drive the process forward in the absence of a viral infection. That's kind of the classic view for many cancers.
Right.
And the other model highlighted here is where a viral infection first establishes a persistent latent state, and then specific subsequent mutations, often in these different genes like the RNA helicases, DDX3X, and EIF4A1, contribute to the final malignant transformation. This fundamental distinction is absolutely critical if we want to develop more targeted, more effective therapies that are tailored to the unique biology driving these different cancer pathways.
So if our listeners take just one key thing away from this deep dive today, what should it be?
I'd say it's that our understanding of cancer just got significantly richer. This study clearly reveals that virus-associated cancers are a truly distinct category. They're characterized by unique epidemiology, who gets them where, and perhaps why. They often have a lower overall mutation burden, but with specific crucial driver mutations in genes like DDX3X and EIF4A1. And importantly, they show a greater responsiveness to certain immunotherapies.
And this distinct biology offers completely new pathways, not just for understanding how cancer develops, but crucially for improving treatment strategies for potentially millions of people around the globe.
Exactly. And it leaves us with a really important question to ponder. What does this mean for how we should approach cancer prevention and treatment going forward, especially in those parts of the world where these viral infections are most prevalent? It's a question that could genuinely change lives.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoy this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, Base by Base.